Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio, 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Araceli Gomez.
And I'm Kelly Worley. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, June 22nd, 2016.
We've never had enough to know to have a comfortable cushion of foster families. We're always in need, and we need families from all kinds of different cultures and backgrounds.
A recent increase of children in the child welfare system has sparked a need for foster families. More on that later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Richard Fish warns about scams related to the mass shooting in Orlando on a new edition of our Consumer Watchdog segment, Better Beware. But first, your daily headlines.
Lawmakers and web-based businesses have been scrambling over the past week to respond to a new court ruling on net neutrality. A U.S. appeals court ruled that the Federal Communications Commission has the authority to regulate broadband internet services. That's because, according to the court, broadband internet is a telecommunications service. IU researcher Barbara Cherry's work has been cited multiple times by the FCC in a court of law, and she says that this argument of whether the internet is a telecommunications service has been going on for years.
Starting in 2002, the FCC classified certain broadband internet access services as what's called an information service under our federal law. And by classifying it in that category of services, the FCC has the weakest jurisdiction over. And so when the FCC tried since then a couple of times to issue rulings related to net neutrality, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the FCC and said, well, you classified it as an information service, so you don't have jurisdiction to do what you want to do.
The FCC then filed suit in 2015 to reclassify broadband services as a telecommunications service.
So in the 2015 order, a major thing the FCC did was to reclassify broadband internet access service from information service to a telecommunications service. Legally, what that means is if it's a telecommunications service, then the FCC has jurisdiction over it under a certain portion of federal law.
Last week's federal ruling was in response to an appeal on that 2015 order. Multiple internet providers believed that the FCC was overstepping their boundaries and interfering with their freedom of speech. Barbara Cherry says that since internet service providers are only carriers of information, they are not guaranteed First Amendment rights.
If you're a common carriage company, then you don't control the content of the information. You're just a conduit. And the way our Supreme Court over the years has interpreted the First Amendment, that in terms of just your function of being a common carriage and moving information around, you do not have First Amendment rights as to that function.
Since losing the appeal, providers such as AT&T have said they plan to take the case to the U.S. Supreme Court.
The city of Bloomington is taking advantage of I-69 construction to expand its digital connectivity. In its meeting last night, the Bloomington Redevelopment Commission unanimously approved a project to install fiber optic conduits in three bridges being built over I-69. The project is part of the city's digital underground program to install fiber optic cable throughout the city. Technology Services Director Rick Dietz said taking advantage of the current I-69 construction will save money in the long run.
One of our main goals with our infrastructure program has always been to take advantage of road builds and others that would provide us with strategic opportunities to place infrastructure. This happens to be one of those. By placing the infrastructure now and doing so in the bridges, which is our intent over Vernal, 2nd and 3rd Street, that would save us a lot in terms of the cost for placing that infrastructure at a later time. And it would allow us to span the I-69 roadway in three different locations and allow us to connect on the west side of the I-69 roadway in the future with minimal expense.
Dietz said the conduits will be built with hand holes or manholes to allow for expanding the fiber optic capacity in the future. The project is expected to cost $250,000. In other business, the commission approved using $8,900 in consolidated TIF funding to improve the intersection of Tap Road and Brockport Road. Transportation engineer Andrew Seabor said the money is needed for additional design services.
Towards the end of last year, when we were going through and looking at various projects, determined this would be a good project for TIF funding. And knowing there was a chance that we might have a little bit of additional design services, we need to wrap up. And we are to that stage where I think we're looking for about $13,925 in total. $5,000 of that would be actually funded through the City of Bloomington Utilities Department for a water main extension. So really we're talking $8,925 for this resolution.
The intersection's redesign has been long in the making. The original project plan from 2009 involved installing a roundabout. Current plans have replaced the roundabout with a traffic signal and include a multi-use path on the north side of Tap Road and a sidewalk on the south side. On Rockport Road, a sidewalk will be extended on the road's west side and a multi-use path will be added on the east side. Though the intersection is not located within the consolidated TIF district, the project is deemed to improve accessibility and therefore development in the area.
Although Hoosiers have a do not call list, scammers sometimes ignore it. In response to over 14,000 complaints in 2015 and more than 50 complaints per day thus far in 2016, Attorney General Greg Zeller is taking legal action against violators of the do not call list. Indiana has joined 10 other states, the Federal Trade Commission, the U.S. Department of Justice, and several other law enforcement agencies in a national sweep to halt robocall operations. Since January of this year, 39 actions have been taken to prosecute offenders. Zeller's current lawsuit against a group going by the name Beyond Medical USA seeks civil penalties of $25,000 for each wrongful call. The number of calls is estimated to be more than 55,000. Zeller urges Hoosiers to help by visiting indianaconsumer.com or calling 1-888-834-9969. His office has also created a call blocking reference sheet at in.gov/attorneygeneral.
Pollinators such as bees and butterflies are responsible for 35% of global crop production and their population is declining. The Division of Fish and Wildlife and the Natural Resources Conservation Service work to increase the pollinator population by regularly establishing grassland and woodland habitats on both public and private lands. Their projects provide financial and technical assistance to those willing to create habitats anywhere, like fields, farms, roadsides, forests, and backyards. Locate your local wildlife biologist online at wildlife.in.gov or call Michelle Kane at 317-234-8240.
Experts warn there may be consequences for kids who overuse smartphones and tablets. Ann Comer from Cincinnati's Children's Hospital Medical Center says that when kids are on devices, they are not only missing out on verbal interaction, but also physical language. Quote, "What's most important in communication development and also in the development of relationships is direct communication, which means that you look at each other, you have eye contact, you laugh together, and that is not well done through devices," unquote. Results from a new poll from the American Speech Language Hearing Association reveal that pathologists' biggest concern is that excessive technology use is replacing conversation and human interaction and may cause irreversible damage to the communication skills of future generations. Comer notes there have been significant hearing loss in young people, which coincides with an increase in MP3 players and iPods. Parents can help by modeling safe technology use, setting reasonable boundaries for time spent on devices, and keeping the volume at half level. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Kelly Worley.
And I'm Araceli Gomez. An increase of children in the child welfare system is sparking an urgent need for foster families. Sarah Vaughn speaks with Jamie Lawrence Nichols with the local office of the Indiana Division of Child Services, about the fostering process. We bring you their conversation now for today's WFHB Community Report.
According to the Annie E. Casey Foundation, the number of children in foster care has increased for the first time in more than a decade. There are over 400,000 children in the child welfare system nationwide. Many of those who work in child welfare believe the increase is in large part due to an uptick in substance abuse. 4 out of every 10 children are taken from their parents because of physical or sexual abuse, 13% as a result of abandonment, and 8% because of neglect. In Indiana, there were nearly 12,000 children in foster care in 2013. The last year numbers are available, according to the Casey Foundation's Kids Count Data Center. Advocates for foster children say there is a critical need for foster parents. I spoke about the fostering process with Jamie Lawrence Nichols, supervisor for foster care with the Indiana Department of Child Services, Region 13. How many families are needed in Monroe County? How many families are you short right now?
We've never had enough to know to be have a comfortable cushion of foster families. We're always in need, and we need families from all kinds of different cultures and backgrounds. So we need families of color. We need families who speak Spanish. We need families who want to accept teens. We need families who want to accept babies and grade school age children.
How long typically does a child who's been removed from their biological family have to wait for a foster home in Monroe County?
Well, we always look at family first. So we don't go straight to foster care. We research the family ties and kinship ties within the community to try to keep kids in familiar family home settings. They don't necessarily wait. We do have some kids that may go to older kids that maybe go to a shelter situation or something like that. But we place in foster care on an emergency basis. Usually we remove on an emergency basis and place in a foster home at that time. But we don't put kids in like residential facilities and wait until we have a foster home. Sometimes when they're waiting for a longer term placement, they'll wait with a foster family for a short period. We do have some teenagers that can stay like at the youth shelter for 20 days until we have to have a longer term placement. But what typically ends up happening is we are Department of Child Services, so we're statewide. So we communicate with private agencies that provide foster care services and other foster care specialists throughout the state. What typically ends up happening is they get moved out of their community, which is very, very sad. They have to have some place to be. They have to, and so we find them a place in a foster family home setting. But it may not be close to home and close to their school and close to their family, extended family, or their biological family for visits. And so that becomes sad. It's very sad for kids to lose both their biological family and their community, their social network, and all their friends.
Typically, how long does a child stay in foster care, or is there an average?
I don't really feel like there is a good average that I could give you with any kind of confidence, but we cannot file for termination of parental rights until after 1 year. That's when we start looking at a permanency plan for children.
Are there very many children, or how many children might go back to their biological families after a stint in foster care?
That's another statistic that I don't have, but it is more than what I think people realize, are successfully reunified with their families.
Do you have to be married, or can a single person be a foster parent?
Absolutely, a single person can be a foster parent, yes.
And what's the training for that?
There are 10 hours of pre-service training, 3 classes in total. If you're interested in adoption, there is a fourth course for adoption specifically, but the classes are an introduction to the agency, which is a face-to-face 3-hour class. We also have a 4-hour online training that talks about the impact of abuse and neglect. And then there is a third and separate training that is the effects of caregiving on the family and discipline approaches. That's also a 3-hour face-to-face class, and you can usually finish those in about 2 weeks. If you need to take the adoption class, it takes a bit longer because those are offered less frequently.
And of course, there are background checks and medical histories that are involved when someone applies. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We do ask that you have a physical, and a doctor needs to complete a statement regarding your medical history and ability to care for children.
What is the time frame for approval to be a foster family or a foster parent?
Our agency here in Monroe and surrounding counties, we are actually we're broken up within regions. So we have Monroe, Brown, Green, Owen, and Lawrence counties within our region. So I have foster care specialists in all of those counties that I supervise. And our average is about 4 months, 4 to 6 months to get somebody licensed. Applicants have up to a year to complete their licensure. We do also license relatives who have accepted placement of children and need, you know, financial supports and the things that go along with that that license. But yeah, usually we can get it done within between 4 and 6 months.
Is there a certain level of financial commitment then in becoming for the child once you're a foster parent, or does the state provide some support for, say, medical bills and clothing, et cetera?
We do. We have allowances for clothing. We have allowances. Kids get what we call a personal allowance, which is $300 every year to buy wants, not the needs. That's covered through what we call per diem, which is a daily amount provided per child to account for their care, to reimburse for their care. And that ranges based on the level of need and supervision that kiddo requires.
What are the characteristics that most successful foster parents and families have? Can you identify, you know, a background or a particular effective communication or resilience? I'm just curious about what characteristics or traits do the most successful foster families have?
I think the number one trait that's really important is you have to be flexible and you have to be committed. The kiddos come to us having experienced a lot of trauma, and so their behaviors reflect that trauma. So you have challenging behaviors, and committing to those kiddos and sticking with them throughout their time in care is the only way to show them stability, which is key to addressing trauma.
Are there support systems in place once you become a foster parent to help you deal with what may turn out to be a very troubled child?
Yeah, we have services. We put services in place for kids as needed. We get feedback from foster parents about what's going on in the home and the behaviors that we're seeing and any kind of challenges kiddos might have. This is what I hear the most is, how am I going to give them back? Like, how do I get attached to this kiddo and then send them back home? We provide support. You have a foster care specialist who can help you sort of move through those emotional challenges.
Is it possible for foster parents to stay in touch with a foster child once that child has moved on?
We actually really do encourage positive communication between foster parents and biological parents. Foster parents can become informal supports for biological parents even after that case is closed, and that is ideal. That's ideal because you know where a kiddo is going back to. You know about the progress the parents have made and that they're really ready for reunification to happen. They want to be with their parents. They always want to be with their parents. Also, I think one of the things that we see consistently for parents who become involved with the child welfare system is that they don't have positive supports in their life, and foster parents can help with that. So you can help a whole family, not just the child.
I've been speaking with Jamie Lawrence Nichols, Supervisor for Foster Care and Relative Support for Monroe County. Thank you so much for your time, Jamie. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You can find out more about being a foster parent in Indiana from the Indiana DCS website at in.gov/DCS or by calling the Foster Care Helpline at 888-631-9510. You can review the Casey Foundation's report there as well.
Coming up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
It happens every time. Every time there's a major tragedy in the news, scammers crawl out from under rocks and start asking for money. They say it's going to the poor victims, but it doesn't. They just keep it. Talk about lowlifes. These people are so low they could put on a tall silk hat and walk under a duck. Earthquakes, floods, superstorms, it doesn't matter if the disaster is natural or man-made. Now, of course, it's the nightclub massacre in Orlando. We had a great response here in Bloomington, with more than 1,000 people, all kinds, all shapes and sizes and colors and ages and backgrounds and religions, gathered to mourn the victims and send a message that love conquers terror and we're not afraid. Now, the Indiana Attorney General and lots of others are warning that fake Orlando charities are already popping up like poison toadstools after a rain. If you want to help, good for you. But make certain your contribution goes where you want it to go. Here are some don'ts and do's. Never give cash. Don't use a debit card and don't ever wire money. Write a check or use a credit card so the money can be traced. Online, never respond to pop-up windows or email appeals. Even if they don't get your money, they can be malware traps or phishing scams. In general, don't respond to charities who find you. Instead, you find them. And don't give to any appeal that's vague about how or when the money will be used. Legitimate charities will be specific about all that. Do check out any charity before you give. CharityNavigator.org has a big Orlando banner on their website now, always a good place to look. CharityNavigator, all one word, .org. Or you can check the Indiana Attorney General's website or the IRS website. One thing to look at is how much of the organization's income goes to the good cause and how much they spend on themselves for salaries, fundraising costs, and overhead. At the very least, 70 cents out of every dollar you give ought to go to the victims, and plenty of charities do much better than that. Those that don't deserve your money. Beware of charities with similar-sounding names. The American Red Cross is a perfectly legitimate organization, but something called, say, Red Cross Donations dot whatever might be a scam. And if you get a phone call or a letter or an email thanking you for a donation you never made, watch out. Fraudsters hope you'll be curious and check it out. Instead, just forget about it. Crowdfunding is big these days, with honest people and with crooks. Legitimate crowdfunders will be legitimate 501c3 nonprofits and will have some established third party, like a bank, receive the money. We've said it before, and I'm sure we'll have to say it again. Do give, but do beware. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at WFHB.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@WFHB.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Casey Ross and Kathy Norton, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Sarah Vaughn.
Our engineers today are Heather Perry and Rob Schoon. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Kelly Worley.
And I'm Araceli Gomez. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program, recognized among the best newscast in 2015 by the Indiana chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news@wfhb.org. Stay tuned for Standing Room Only, our award-winning weekly lecture series, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.